Welcome to Conversations in Care, the flagship radio program of the CARE Radio Network. The radio program dedicated to covering senior health topics, chronic conditions, and self-care. Using the simple act of conversation, we can create awareness, establish a course of action, and design a community of support. Conversations in Care was created from the many conversations throughout her 18-year involvement as a dementia practitioner, care advocate, and your host, Tammy Newman.
Good evening and welcome to Conversations in Care. I am Tammy, your host, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in this evening. We have some really great, wonderful guests this evening. But before we do that, before I introduce you to what we're going to talk about today, I just wanted to thank everyone that has been a listener and that has been a huge supporter of mine and also of the radio show. As many of you know, the past month was definitely a difficult time for me. My mother was on hospice and ended up passing away, so I had to take a few weeks off. And then once I did return home, I ended up losing my voice. So as you can kind of tell, it's still a little raspy, but the one thing that, as Tony knows, my associate producer, one of the things that is so important to me and one of my most favorite things to do in the week is to be on the show and to really share some really great and wonderful information with all of you. So without further ado, I want to tell you that the two guests that I have on the show today, both are authors and both have written some really fabulous books. So our first author that's on the show this evening is Dr. Stephen Lamb. And Dr. Lamb is someone that has written a book that's called Fighting Fat, Break the Dieting Cycle, and Get Healthy for Life. So Dr. Lamb is a little bit famous, so I'm very excited that he came onto the show because he hangs out on a regular basis with the ladies on The View, and he is also a practicing internist and director of the NYU Preston Robert Tisch Center for Men's Health. Dr. Lamb, welcome to Conversations in Care.
Well, thank you so much, and number one, obviously, my condolences to you, and I know your mother is very proud of what you do and what you've done, so I know what it's like to lose a mother, so I appreciate the fact that you're still doing this and doing it today.
You know, absolutely. This is one of my things that brings me a lot of joy, so I want to thank you for your condolences, and I want to thank you for being on the show, and it's kind of funny because Tony and I, my associate producer, he's kind of in the background at the moment, and I might bring him on in a few minutes because him and I last night, we were really talking about losing weight because we both have kind of started on a road to lose weight, and we both are doing it very differently. And as I was really kind of going over my notes again, I think that's what's really great about your book is you talk about why it's more important to gain health rather than just lose the weight. So I wanted you to maybe tell us a little bit about maybe why you decided to write this book and a little bit about that concept of gaining health rather than losing weight.
Yeah. Well, I think that, look, obesity is really a major epidemic, obviously, in this country and most industrialized countries. And it's the main driver for medical problems in this country. That and smoking are the two leading contributors. And I would bet that obesity probably is going to, overwhelm even smokers. When I say the driver, I think most of us recognize that obesity contributes to diabetes and heart disease and arthritis and sleep problems and psychiatric issues. And I think that some people probably even realize that it increases the risk for obesity. For cancer. So I think that when you're practicing internist, you have to deal with all of these conditions. And unless you can address the primary obesity issue, weight issue, the likelihood of you really changing the course of people's health or wellness without dealing with the obesity issue is flawed. Now, we're very good at managing diabetes, the disease, with a variety of medications and lifestyle changes. And we're very good at dealing with hypertension and we're dealing with disease. But we've been very neglectful of managing the primary driver, which is obesity. And that's been an area of interest to me for a very long time, because I've had to ask myself a question, why are intelligent, motivated people across the country, across all socioeconomic barriers, or across socioeconomic educational status, why is there such a great amount of obesity in this country, despite the fact that nobody really wants to be fat? And why do some of the most articulate, intelligent, accomplished people in this country, both in politics and in show business and in education and within the medical profession, who know the dangers of being overweight, why are they still overweight? I mean, do we actually think that these individuals want to be fat? Do we think that they haven't figured out that certain diets, might be helpful in losing weight? So it's an area that I think it has really troubled me and perplexed me for the last 25 years. And, I can say that I've probably been a little bit more successful than most physicians, because I've really started to be very clear that there has to be a biology involved, there has to be a science involved with managing obesity. And I'm very pleased to tell you that, 1 or 2 years ago, American Endocrine Society, American Medical Society, a whole bunch of societies that sort of acknowledged obesity as a disease, as opposed to a character flaw, as opposed to a disorder which simply needs to be treated by willpower. And with a growing amount of science involved with understanding hunger and satiety, that is when you feel full, with metabolism, with energy expenditure, it became very clear that the medical profession needed to participate in the approach to managing this overwhelmingly serious condition. And simply telling patients you need to eat less and exercise more was not going to work, and it hasn't worked. And there's a reason that it doesn't work. And when you start to understand the basis for obesity, then I think you can start to create a program that will help. And I think that was what the book was all about. It's, by the way, it's co-authored by head of psychopharmacology at NYU, Dr. Norman Sussman, and two of the bariatric surgeons, Dr. Fielding and Dr. Wren. And we tried to, in the book, really explain pretty clearly the factors and the barriers and the obstacles to weight issues. And an approach that I think, your listeners, if they read the book, can hopefully bring to their physician who's open-minded and understands, there's been a lot of research done, actually Nobel Prize-winning research, in the last 15 years, which is going to change how we treat and how we deal with obesity. So in a nutshell, that's why I wrote the book, it's really the funny thing is I write books for the general public, but really deep in my heart, I'm really writing it for the doctors. And, whether it's a book that I've written on sexuality or dealing with gut issues and irritable bowel, whatever, they're really, we write in a fashion that's understandable by the general public, but it's scientifically correct, so that physicians can read this, and if they care to be open-minded and receptive, that maybe they can help some of their patients as well. So that's why I wrote the book.
Well, and there's some questions that I want to ask you about in regards to biology, but I think one of the things that I really kind of want to point out to anybody that's listening in regards to this book is that throughout the chapters you have at the end, you've created some sheets that, or pages, that the person that's reading this can really look at. It says tips for talking to your doctor. So you can kind of write down some of your thoughts. You can bring this to your doctor, because I think talking about your weight with your doctor is very difficult in the first place, because typically you hear, okay, exercise more, eat less. And sometimes, as you kind of state in this book, that maybe it's not just that exact thing for everyone. Maybe it's a little bit different for each person and how that's going to look. But it gives that person the ability to really look at how they're going to start that conversation with their physician. And right. I really like that you added those pieces in the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think that it's a problem for both the patient and the doctor. For example, patient will come in who's clearly significantly overweight. and they know they're overweight, you know they're overweight, and now they're coming in with a host of medical issues that are directly related to their obesity. You know, whether it's severe hip and back pain, whether it's their blood sugar being out of control, whether it's their blood pressure out of control. And it's almost, and I hate to use this particular analogy because, it's like the elephant in the room, you know?
Right.
Which, you know, I mean, I know that's not the perfect elegant analogy, but you understand what I'm saying, that, you know, you have to somehow figure out a way of having either the patient acknowledge that their weight is an issue, because if they don't acknowledge it, if they don't want to believe that this is a problem, I can't help them. This is way too difficult a problem. And the physician also has to be extremely sensitive in understanding that patients know that they're overweight. And if you simply say to them, well, your blood pressure is the way it is because you're 30 pounds overweight, or your back hurts because you're 30 pounds overweight, or your knee hurts because you're, that's really not very effective.
Right.
It's an art in how you introduce the subject, and it shouldn't be rushed. In other words, it's not, you know, this is a complex disorder. So when the patients come in with a backache and they're 30 pounds overweight, I don't spend the time talking about their weight. I simply say to them something like, as you can imagine, your weight is a contributing factor. If one day you'd like to talk to me about it, we do have some innovative approaches. And that's all you do. You just introduce it, and you say, you know, if you're interested, please make another appointment, and we'll be happy to talk about it. You know, and you just keep it at that. And those individuals who are receptive, then obviously it works, and they come back, and then you have an opportunity to talk about it that way.
Right.
In those patients who, you know, come to the doctor and say to them, look, I've got a weight problem, I need you to help me, for the doctor to dismiss them and say, why don't you just eat less and exercise more, without understanding why they're eating more and why they can't exercise, or why they can't exercise effectively, is also a waste of time. Why they keep doing that when 95% of the patients for the last X number of years that they've been practicing fail with that approach is beyond me. I mean, you'd think that they would, you know, if somebody came with a strep throat and they kept giving you, you know, a plant herb and it didn't cure your strep throat, I would stop doing that. I would find some other. So that's really, you know, we're actually, you know, at a fork in the road, and I really do think that the medical profession, you know, is over the next few years going to start getting more and more discussions and talking about the science of obesity and some of the scientific approaches that are really going to hopefully make a difference in improving the health of the patient, and that health-centric approach that I'm talking to you about, rather than the weight-centric approach. It's not about losing 5 or 10 pounds. It's how many pounds you need to lose for your blood sugar to improve, for your triglycerides to improve, for your blood pressure to get lower, for you to be at a lower risk for certain cancers. And that's really the approach.
Well, there was one stat that you had in the book that says that even if there's a 5 to 10% decrease in body weight, that there are some significant health benefits. And I think that's really important for any of us struggling with, you know, losing weight or trying to find our best way to lose weight, that even a small amount of weight loss can really show some benefits.
Right. I think that the reason that we put that in is because, you know, there's a perception that, you know, unless I lose 50 pounds, I'm not even going to worth trying it, because if I can't lose 50 pounds, I won't try. And there's plenty of data that shows that 5 and 10% reductions significantly improve metabolic systems. I mean, there's no question about it. It means going from, you know, being on insulin to not being on insulin, to being on a blood pressure medicine to not being on. So those 5 or 10%, is very important. By the way, the word struggling to lose weight, I have news for you. Every single person who tries to lose weight is going to struggle. And they're going to struggle because it's contrary to their biology. You know, we've all been genetically created in some ways and evolved to defend against weight loss. And that's because, you know, we have to live in environments where there is a scarcity of food. And so the body goes into a protective mode, and it genetically is created so that your metabolic rate changes, you start to develop signals that promote you seeking food, finding food. So all of us are in that state, and explains why we have so much trouble, quote, losing weight. or at least keeping the weight off. And then there are a whole bunch of us who have inherited genes that actually promote weight gain. And you can see that in twin studies and in families, that they actually have inherited genes that, you know, have altered signals, altered hormones in their body, altered metabolism that really increases their risk. So if you are, in a nutshell, genetically at risk for gaining weight, and you're put into an environment where there is a excess amount of calorie-dense but not nutrient-dense food that is cheap, that's available, and then you decrease the amount of physical activity that you expect people to have to do in a day, right? Either they're not farmers or lumberjacks anymore. And
right.
If you increase the stress level, and if you decrease the sleep, it's a perfect storm. It's genetics and environment. So it's unquestionable that you're going to have a huge population of overweight and fat people because we've created that environment. And unless we recognize that, I mean, you can't approach it, you can't blame anybody because that's the environment we're living in.
Absolutely. And, you know, because what I enjoyed about this book is that, you know, I got to see inside some things, meaning, you know, learn a little bit about the concepts of why we're fat, which, like you said, have to do with genetics. There was also a chapter that talked about what medications might be helping us to gain weight.
Those are the barriers. You know, I love it when people say, well, you know, we haven't changed our genes, but we've got fatter. Yeah, that's true, but we've changed the environment. So that's where the genes, by the way, and the environment, you know, come together in determining why we're so overweight. You know, the same people who are fat today would have been fat relative to other people in 1930 or 1870. But because they had to work so hard physically and because they didn't have all of these high-calorie foods and fast foods available to them, they didn't realize their genetic potential. But on top of everything, we have now created barriers. And so when you're taking a medication, for example, for depression, which may be a perfectly good drug for depression, the problem is that the collateral damage from that medication, almost all psychiatric drugs, with rare exception, there are a few, you know, that the technical ones that I can mention, but with rare exception, they'll all promote weight gain, whether it's 5 pounds, 10 pounds, 20 pounds, or 50 pounds. To the point that many of these drugs are so obesogenic, so likely to cause obesity, that we're starting to question whether they should be used at all. So you may be taking something that's innocent. You may be taking a beta blocker and not realize that that's contributing to obesity, or even a sleeping medicine that promotes, you know, binge eating. So you've got to look at the medications. You have to look at person's sleep cycle, because if you're not sleeping, if you go to sleep at 2 o'clock in the morning and get up at 6 in the morning, the likelihood is you're going to get overweight over time. You know, if you are, you know, a shift worker, and so many of our people in this country are shift workers and are eating and sleeping at odd times, that's a major contributor to weight gain, by the way. And so you have to really look at all of the factors, all of the barriers in any one individual. And that's why we said that one size doesn't fit all, that you really have to have a physician who is really interested in understanding biology. It's not about, quote, finding the perfect diet. There are many excellent diets. I use diet as a noun. That is, a diet should be rich in nutrients, all right? It's something that a person enjoys doing and uses food as a nutrient. And whether it is one, quote, healthy diet or another healthy diet really doesn't matter to me, okay? That's not the problem. People know what healthy foods, you know, what foods are healthy and one type or another. And your next guest will probably talk to you about a very good diet. That's fine. But dieting is really insane, okay? Trying to temporarily, quote, restrict your calories just sends signals to your body to reject it, and it doesn't work. And it hasn't worked in anybody because it's not sustainable.
Right?
That's you understand what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. And I think, what I hear you saying in regards to all of this is that, you know, really kind of learn what some of the things are that could be hindering you losing
Perfect.
Weight. and exactly. and really working with your doctor and finding what is the best way for you to lose the weight
right.
and get healthier. Because, you know, I thought it was interesting because there's a chapter in here that you talk about fat but fit, I think is the
right.
fit but fat.
Right.
And I thought that was very interesting because I think there's some people that really do fit that description.
Right. I mean, there are people who appear who are fat, okay, and who are also fit. And the hope was that maybe they could avoid some of the problems that afflict people who are, quote, fat but not fit. It turns out that when you follow these individuals over a 10 or 15-year period, many of these individuals, unfortunately, start to show signs of metabolic, what we call dysregulation. There are abnormalities in insulin and other issues that I wish were avoidable.
Mm-hmm.
But just, for example, just like there are smokers who could live to age 90 and not get lung cancer, yeah, right.
Right.
But there's still a problem with their lungs, okay? And they're going to be people who are overweight. Just reflect about people that you see on the street. How many older individuals are still fat? You don't see a lot, all right, because they've succumbed to other diseases. You know, there are some, but not a lot. Right.
Right. Right.
So you know we're selecting out you know a few people who are at the end of the you know the two standard deviations away from the curve and they do okay. But don't delude yourself into thinking that you could remain fit and fat. That ultimately you're going to develop some issues. And the other thing is you need to find a doctor who is knowledgeable. I mean you need to go to somebody who is passionate about managing and dealing with the complexity of obesity. I think that it's easier to cure people of Hodgkin's disease than it is dealing with obesity. With Hodgkin's disease, you give them chemotherapy, they do fine. But that's not the way. With obesity, you need a lot of participation with the patient. And there's only so much the doctor can do and so much pharmacotherapy, which is fraught with certain side effects as well. But I think that we're going to change the concepts. It's not a disorder that's going to be treated by willpower. That's the bottom line.
No, and I really appreciate the book because it not only covers, you know, the things that are making us heavy, it also covers some of the options that are out there. And I think
right.
it's important to really understand those options when that time comes. And, you know, and definitely if you're working to, and this is just my opinion here, that, you know, sometimes if you're working with a doctor that you don't feel is doing best by you, then sometimes it's really important to find that second opinion and find who can
yep.
really support you in that journey.
Or you may need somebody who really specializes in the weight management. And I think that, you know, there are plenty of now, you know, the Bariatric Society and some of the endocrine societies. There are physicians who are really comfortable with managing obesity and because it's very, it's complicated and
mm-hmm.
it's a two, you know, you really need a dialogue with patients and the doctor needs to know what are the specific barriers, what are the drugs that the patient is taking that you could change, that you can alter. How do you change somebody's sleep cycle? How do you change, you know, the biggest problem you see these people now who are traveling, you know, 2-3 times a week, their circadian rhythm is so their internal clock, that's what circadian rhythm is so messed up that it creates a chaotic situation for the body, which promotes weight gain.
Right.
Anytime there's chaos in somebody's life, and for example, unfortunately, you've suffered a tragedy and you're in the loss of your mom, that oftentimes over a period of 6 months, you know, is so disruptive to the individual that they're going to see a weight change. They'll either go up or they'll go down. The likelihood of their staying the same is not very great. So what you might do is point out to the person, look, you're getting married, you're getting a new job, you're moving to another environment, like students who go to college, you know.
Right.
That change causes chaos, and that chaos is a stimulus over a period of time for weight change. And that's what we see all the time. So if you alert somebody to that, you can say, look, you're moving from Texas to New York. It's a new environment. You're going to have new friends, new this, new that. You're going to start to use food a little differently. You can use it as a drug, Right. You're eating especially carbs, okay? And, you know, don't be surprised, but monitor that way. So as I became the director of NYU Center for Men's Health, which is really just an amazing place in New York City, and I was monitoring my own weight over the year, and I think I gained 2 or 3 pounds, nothing. So I felt that that was an indicator that I was actually working well, that I actually was accommodating and adjusting to this new responsibility in a healthy way. Because I was aware that that change could be a stimulus for weight gain.
Absolutely. Dr. Lam, everything that you've said has been really wonderful information for everybody that's listening, because I think it's important to, even if we're fit right now, it, like you said, just making sure that in the future we know what's happening, you know, could really change our what's happening to our body as well.
Yeah. Yes.
So,
well,
Dr. Lam,
I appreciate the time.
Oh, absolutely. And how can people find out more about you, your book, everything that you're doing?
Well, I mean, once again, I think that anybody who's in New York who wants to visit us, you know, I'm Dr. Stephen Lam, and I'm the director of men's health at NYU, and it's our center is at 555 Madison Avenue in New York. It's really, you know, we received a $15 million grant from the Tisch family. We have, it's a multi-specialty, you know, it's really amazing. We were on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, this is a major center. And we're happy to see anybody. And certainly reading the book, bringing the book to your doctor. If your doctor wants to call me up and speak to me on the phone, I'd be happy to do that. You know, I can't obviously speak to every one of your listeners on the phone. It's just not practical. But, you know, we'd be more than happy to see anybody in New York City, and hopefully we can, you know, make a change in people's lives.
That's wonderful. We'll put all your information up on our Facebook page, how they can find the book and find your website, because your website has some really great information on it as well.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you so much for taking some time to be on Conversations in Care today.
I wish you well.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Tony Fisher about the Fisher Report, and we're also going to be talking with our guest author, Donna Jackson Nakazawa.
Just like mom is there to make you a bowl of soup when you're sick, Culinary Care is there when you're fighting cancer. The Chicago-based nonprofit organization delivers complimentary meals to ensure individuals fighting cancer don't have to worry about feeding themselves or their family. It's a simple mission with a profound impact. Learn more at culinarycare.org.
All seniors and caregivers have one thing in common. They all want to age well and enjoy a good quality of life. Fortunately, there are thousands of services available in the Chicagoland area to help you and your loved one maintain a high quality of life. The Seniors Blue Book is a free resource guide available at all Good Neighbor Pharmacy locations. The sole purpose of the Seniors Blue Book is to help guide and educate its readers about the myriad of services and organizations that are here to help seniors age well. The Seniors Blue Book lists over 50 categories of senior resources, senior housing, home health comparison grids, and editorials written by local professionals about issues like guardianship, reverse mortgage, and Cook, Will, and DuPage County aging services. Visit www.seniorsbluebook.com today.
If you are just joining us on Conversations in Care, we just finished talking to Dr. Stephen Lam, and about the book that he just recently wrote, Fighting Fat, Break the Dieting Cycle, and Get Healthy for Life. Now, I know Associate Producer Tony Fisher. Tony, what we'll be doing is we'll be getting that information up on the Facebook page so that you can find where to get the book and also his website. It's got some really great information, and it's also got some of the videos when he was with the ladies on The View. So definitely take a look at all that information. So next is our guest, Donna Jackson Nakazawa. Donna has actually been on Conversations in Care before, and I'm so excited to bring her back. She was actually supposed to be on the show last week. However, last week I had no voice what to speak of, so we weren't able to have her on the show, and she was able to launch her new book called Childhood Disrupted, How Your Biography Becomes Your Biology and How You Can Heal. Donna, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tammy, it's great to be back.
You know what? Thank you so much. I'm just fascinated by the concepts that you talk about, and this book has really actually had me like hooked, because I think this is just amazing stuff and stuff that I had no idea was out there. And I think maybe where I want to start in regards to our conversation is when I first had you on the show, you were on and you were talking about your book. I think it was The Last Best Cure is what you were talking about.
Correct.
And we talked a lot about how you were really trying to heal yourself from going through this bout, and maybe bout's a small word, but you dealt with quite a few different autoimmune diseases. And I was hoping that maybe you can start there and kind of share your story and what you've been through.
Sure. So I think for a lot of us, and I think for you, Tammy, like me, our careers become a convergence of the personal and the professional. And so for me as a science journalist, I've been writing books for 20 years. I've written 5 books. And for the last 10 years, those books have really focused on the intersection between our neurobiology, our immunology, and really the deepest inner workings of the human heart, with just a hope to help people suffering from chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
So when you and I met, I had already written The Autoimmune Epidemic, which looked at these doubling and tripling rising rates of autoimmunity, especially for women, why it was happening, what was going on in our environment with our immune systems. And in the middle of writing that book, it became really clear to me that there was a toxin that we weren't talking very much about when we talk about chemical toxins, infections, and foods that can complicate how well our immune system will work. And that toxin is really what's created by our own stress reactivity, that chemical cocktail of hormones and chemicals that are produced by the brain in states of stress. So in The Last Best Cure, really I was looking at the new science of what's called psychoneuroimmunology, or how our thoughts literally create a chemical flood that we marinate in, and that is linked in research study after study to higher rates of inflammation, which, of course, inflammation leads to disease. So you and I had a great talk about that, and every book I write, there's always something I just don't have room to really fully explore. And while I was writing The Last Best Cure, I came across a body of science called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which had since been replicated by over 1,500 studies, peer-reviewed, which are all available in the National Library of Medicine. And this field of research had been completely ignored by the greater medical community. It was being used by community activists, looking at communities in which people had lived very difficult childhoods. But this research, which links 10 types, and now we are looking at more like 15 different types of early adversity, from the very common to the very rare, to much greater rates of disease in adulthood. So I really felt that I had to dig down and explore this for my readers and help them understand not just how toxic stress in adulthood leads to disease, but how toxic stress in childhood, which is beyond a child's control, actually presets the immune system to create more stress hormones throughout the lifespan, and how this is related to higher rate of disease in adulthood and higher levels of inflammation.
Donna, I so find this so fascinating. I've always felt that there's some sort of mind-body connection, that, you know, simple things such as, for example, my mom passing away and me getting sick after she passes away. I feel that there's some sort of connection there. But I think what you're talking about is even more and this is probably not proper English in what I'm going to say, it's almost deeper set when it happens to a child. And I think maybe it should be something that we talk about now, the ACEs, or the adverse childhood experiences, what they are and how they, why they're important to looking at how that person is going to feel in the future, what diseases they might be more preset to. So maybe you can kind of explain that a little bit to us.
Yes, absolutely. So what we know is that there are at least 10 types of adversity that researchers have found when they occur in childhood, they are related to a much greater chance of developing adult disease. So first, let's break down, how do we know this? So in 1998, two really prescient scientists at the CDC and at Kaiser Permanente developed and ran a study with 17,000 adult middle-class Americans. And they asked them, in those health forms that we all fill out when we go to the doctor's office, to answer 10 questions about their childhoods. And these questions included 10 categories of possible adversity. Some of them were what you might expect: sexual abuse, physical abuse, seeing one's mother abused, having a parent who was incarcerated in jail, having a parent who was a drug addict. But they also included things that are fairly common and ubiquitous in American life, such as losing a parent to divorce or for other reasons, such as separation and, of course, death, having parents who were chronically fighting and divorced, having a home in which you were subjected to kind of chronic put-downs and humiliation, which actually had the highest correlation to later developing adult disease.
Oh, wow.
Categories like living with a depressed or mentally ill parent. So how many Americans have grown up with a parent facing alcoholism or depression, or a parent who wasn't able to regulate their own mood and behavior so that they were highly critical or likely to put the child down or engage in blame or shame? Well, it turns out that 64% of these 17,000 adult, middle-class, college-educated Americans answered yes to at least one of these questions. 40% answered yes to two or more. 12.5% answered yes to four or more. So family dysfunction is fairly common. And what was so interesting was that things that we would think any child might just get over, mom and dad's divorce, or, you know, the dad who put them down regularly, but, hey, you know, always said I love you anyway. These common forms of childhood emotional trauma were just as related to a higher inflammatory response that led to far greater chances of disease in adulthood. Anyone with a score of four categories of ACEs is much more likely to develop cancer, autoimmune disease, heart disease, depression. For women, just one ACE score raises your chances of developing autoimmune disease as an adult. And for each ACE score, your chance of developing autoimmunity rises another 20%. So some of these statistics are a little scary. There's good news. We'll get to that. We'll get to the good news. So why does this happen? So let's think about the stress response. The stress response, evolutionarily speaking, functioned in a way so that you saw a tiger, or, you know, today you see a bear in the woods. Your stress response, you go into fight or flight, all these incredibly powerful chemicals, norepinephrine, cortisol, go flushing through your HPA axis, your hypothalamus, your adrenals, your pituitary, and they flood your body with everything you need so that you can fight the bear or run away from the bear. That's why you get butterflies, because all of that all of your blood is rushing away from the gut because right at that moment, right, like digestion isn't that important. It's more important that you can run. So what happens is that that's really great. That's really useful. That's why, you know, if a five-year-old gets caught under a car, mom can lift the car and get her five-year-old out. That's the power of that stress response. But what happens for a child is a little different. What if the bear is mom or dad? What if the bear is mom with depression or bipolar or a mood disorder, and you just never know when she comes in the door what you're going to get? What if the bear is circling the house every day of your life? It's dad coming home from the bar, and you just don't know if he's going to be in a good mood or if you're going to get a smack. What if the bear is a parent who tells you you're stupid and ugly or not good enough and is constantly shaming and blaming every aspect of your behavior? That equates to something called chronic, unpredictable stress. And whereas the brain can handle acute stress and then really recover pretty well from it, like if you tell somebody you're going to get a shot every Tuesday, they'll get the shot and then they're fine. But what if you say to them, and we know this from lab research, we just don't know, we're just going to give you shots whenever we feel like it. Well, the brain's always on alert. And what happens to these kids when the brain is always on alert is that these stress hormones do something really complicated but very interesting. They begin to change the way a developing child's genes will express themselves. The big word for that is epigenetics. And what that basically means is if you think of your genes kind of like flowers, they're supposed to open up and function in a certain way. Well, we're all a product of our gene-environment interaction. And our environment kind of can cause what's technically called gene methylation. And that means that it just suppresses some of these petals on the flowers. The petals don't open. And that changes the way the genes function. So in the case of chronic unpredictable stress for children, those genes are altered so that the stress response stays on all the time. So if we follow that through, what that means is that these kids are growing up marinating in this toxic, pro-inflammatory stress response. Wow, what does that mean? That means migraines, irritable bowel disorder, fibromyalgia, autoimmune disease, heart disease, cancer. It means every which way that the immune system can run amok, it is now far more likely to do so.
You know, Donna, this is just, to me, it's amazing. And, you know, the more I read about this and how, you know, we can, how just sitting in that constant worry and that constant stress, how that really changed us at a really cellular level. And I find that interesting. And, you know, we're getting to the point where I'm going to have you on another show for sure. But I kind of want to talk a little bit before I let you go about, since we see this, we see that we're starting to finally learn that it's not just stress that we might be feeling as adults, but that stress that happened when we were children is really affecting us in much different ways than we ever thought, and really highly giving us the propensity to have all of these awful things happen to us. So how can we either stave that off or become better or heal? What are some of those things that we can do?
Well, there's really great news. And one thing I want to say pretty quickly is that your biology is not your destiny. So there are lots of things that are protective for children. For those of us who are parents listening to this going, oh, my God, you know, I screamed at my teenager last night when I asked him 3 times to take out the trash and he wouldn't get off his computer game. And, you know, now he's, no, not so. So chronic unpredictable toxic stress creates adverse effects when there's not an adult who's completely reliable and pretty consistent there for a child. So one of the things that's most protective for children, and I have a whole section of the book devoted to parents and parenting, is that just having one mentor, one protective adult, is really an ameliorating factor for kids who, even those who grow up with adverse childhood experiences. So I think it's really important to say that unconditional love, parental love, is a boon for a life. So it's really important to say that. And at the same time, for parents to know, the most important gift you can give your children is to regulate your own behavior. Good parenting makes good kids. And parents who've dealt with their own stuff make good kids. So in the book, there are a bunch of strategies for parenting. But for the adult, it's the adult who has to catch the kid who's falling, right? So what do we do for ourselves? Happily, all those epigenetic changes that might have occurred in childhood, science is now telling us that we can reverse those. There are different brain-body approaches that are being shown to reverse those molecular and cellular changes. The one that's been most well-studied, probably won't surprise you or your listeners, is meditation and mindfulness-based stress reduction. They have actually been shown to reverse the changes in the DNA that take place after a lot of chronic, unpredictable, toxic stress. So that's a really good place to start. But I think even before that, one of the most important things for people to remember, I don't think I could say this strongly or often enough, is that when you have had a childhood of adversity, of emotional trauma, it's very hard to be on your own side because you have inculcated and internalized the voice that you're not okay, that you're not deserving, that you don't deserve to heal. And so the most important thing is to activate that sense of self-care so that you can begin to learn these strategies, which include meditation, mindfulness, yoga, but also some really targeted behaviors are having phenomenal results in the research. EMDR therapy, neurofeedback, cognitive behavioral therapy, hypnosis therapy. There are a number of things that people are able to do that downshift the inflammatory response enough that we're actually able to see these changes on a cellular level.
You know what, and it's amazing that these techniques that we can really start to learn and integrate them into our daily lives will really help with this. And the other thing that I feel really good about is that because I was worried as I started reading this book, and I yelled at my son because he didn't take out the garbage. So I'm really glad that.
Who hasn't?
But Donna, I definitely want you to come back because there's some more things that I really want to talk about in this book because it's some really amazing stuff. Because I think it's some stuff that we really need to share with everyone. And before I let you go, I think it's important. You just launched this book last week. How can we find it? How can we learn more about you, your other books that you have written? What's the best place for us to go?
So first of all, the book is available wherever books are sold, your local bookseller, online. If you go to my website, DonnaJacksonNakazawa.com, and I'm sure you'll spell that for people, you can find all the, my publishers put up all the buy buttons for all booksellers. And in addition to that, we have a really robust conversation going on right now at Donna Jackson Nakazawa Author on Facebook. I don't know if your listeners are on Facebook or not, but a lot of people have suddenly found me there, and so it's a great place for them to come to Donna Jackson Nakazawa Author on Facebook, and we can chat there. I will also say that, you know, there's a whole other conversation to be had about how women with chronic illness
are... Yes, I really want to talk about that when you come back.
I know, it's really so interesting to me, and it may lead to actually the next thing that I do, but the relationship between women who have ACE scores or emotional trauma in childhood and growing up to have autoimmune disease and depression is twice as strong as it is for men.
Oh, wow. You know what? This is great stuff. I will contact you about having you back on the show, but
sounds
I will
great.
Make sure that your Facebook page, your website, I'll put all of that on my Facebook page as well, just because that is a long website. So I'll make sure that they have all of that information. And Donna, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Pleasure, and I'm glad you're feeling better. And just remember, sometimes you have to make sure your kids take out the trash.
Thank you. You made me feel so much better about that.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we are going to have the ever-famous Tony Fisher with the Fisher Report.
When you or your loved one are diagnosed with a terminal illness, you enter a time in your life that's more challenging than any you've faced. This season of life can be very confusing, frightening, and lonely. You find yourself dealing with strong emotions and may struggle between hope and fear, doubt and faith. At Peace Hospice and Palliative Care, we understand. We're passionate about our calling and help each individual live as fully as possible. Our aim is to be a caring and professional team that provides end-of-life care while preserving your dignity and enhancing the quality of your life. For more information on how Peace Hospice and Palliative Care can help, please call us at 630-649-7630 or visit us at peacehospice.net and start putting your mind at peace. Are you a person with diabetes? Do you feel hurt and suffocated by it? Are you scared of your diabetes stealing your dreams? The BD's organization will help you find your inner power to turn your story into one of vivid joy, vibrant health, and yes, a sense of ease. And guess what? We use improv too. Find out more at thebeaties.org and we will help you transform your experience because healthcare is a human story.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming back. We had some really great conversations with Dr. Lamb about fighting fat and breaking that dieting cycle. He really had some great information that you can really use and really use with your physician as well. Also, Donna Jackson Nakazawa, she talked to us about her book, Childhood Disrupted, How Your Biography Becomes Your Biology and How You Can Heal. It's an amazing book, and it's so incredibly interesting. So if you have a chance to pick it up, make sure that you go out there and get that book and read along. And she shares some incredible stories of some really brave people that have been through quite disrupting lives. So, without further ado, we have not talked to Tony Fisher in quite some time. And Tony, how are you?
Fine, Tammy. How are you doing? And it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back. That's for sure. Absolutely. So, the Fisher Report. We had a really heavy conversations today, didn't we?
Yeah, we got super geeky today on conversations with Care. Just wanted to remind folks, too, as doing my producer duties, you can catch the episodes of Conversations in Care and all the back episodes on our Blog Talk Radio profile at Conversations in Care on Blog Talk Radio. You can also get links really easily to those things on our Facebook page as well. But I also wanted to talk about the Fisher Report tonight. We're going to feature a couple articles. The first of all is just a little question raised by a lawsuit between the University of San Diego, California, and the University of USC, University of Southern California, about part of the lawsuit is a researcher from UC San Diego went to USC and changed jobs essentially, and he took his whole team with him. But with him went all the funding for Alzheimer's research that the University of California, San Diego was conducting. So the University of California, San Diego is suing USC for the grant money back, but also for a number of other reasons in relation to stealing staff and competitive type reasons. And the main reason for I bring this story up, Tammy, it raises the question, this is all taxpayer money. I mean, this is all money given to these public universities to conduct research funding given to them by the United States government, essentially coming right out of our pocket. And should one university or another be allowed to even file a lawsuit in relation to fighting over data or withholding data from another university if it helps forward the cause of Alzheimer's research?
Oh, Tony Fisher, this is going to get me up on a soapbox.
Well, I like your soapbox. It's nice and sturdy. It's got some stickers on it. That little handle you can carry around. It's nice.
Well, okay, and my thoughts on this are going to be very, very strong in regards to this concept, because when we look at the amount of dollars and the amount of time that has been put into research for Alzheimer's disease versus a lot of the cancers, especially like breast cancer, there's a great disparity in that. There's very little money that's been put into that research comparatively. There's been very few researchers working in this realm. And if we look at the future is that we don't have a cure for this disease. We don't even have anything that's helping to really slow it down. We have all sorts of crazy things going on in regards to that. And we could really, really damage our healthcare system with Alzheimer's disease alone. And my view is that when it comes to fighting something like this, finding a cure, finding, whatever that thing is going to be to help us with this disease, that it's the type of thing that we all work together, that we work together as we share the data, because we're only going to get anywhere if that data is shared. Because if we don't share that data, because we want to look at it genetically, we want to look at it all different ways. And if this project over here needs that data for what they're looking at, we need to share it. We need to not have this lawsuit, because we're losing time and getting a cure, getting a vaccine, getting whatever it is that we need in place for what could cripple the United States in regards to healthcare.
I agree. Alzheimer's is the next major epidemic that we'll be talking about as folks are living longer, Alzheimer's and the various dementias that get misdiagnosed as Alzheimer's disease.
Correct.
So it's the research is vital. On the flip side of this too, I think it should be really forbidden once the data goes. And once the grant money goes to a specific university and that researcher is there, other universities should really kind of be prohibited from, poaching researchers from other universities and bringing them on their campus just for the purpose of getting grant money, essentially.
Right.
That's not
right.
Really
no.
the intention of the grant, and it's something that, like you said, it needs to be a cooperative atmosphere rather than a competitive one.
Absolutely. And I guess, it's surprising to me, and this is where I'm not as educated as I should be in regards to the research process. But I kind of thought that once you got that grant, you really couldn't move until that grant was kind of finished at that point. But
and I think that's kind of the crux of UC San Diego's lawsuit as well. So just an interesting thing that's kind of developed over the last week, and it's something our viewers need to, or our listeners, I'm sorry, thank goodness they're not viewers if they,
I
have
know.
A face for radio, sure.
Well,
but anyway.
My hair's not done, so.
But something our listeners should really need to really understand that, you know, when you give money to the Alzheimer's, to Alzheimer's research or cancer research, you know, there's a lot of politics that goes on behind the scenes with that. And, you know, understanding how that works makes you a more educated advocate for those research processes. The other thing, too, Tammy, I wanted to lighten it up a little bit and talk about a big event that happened in space exploration this week. Pluto, NASA had launched the New Horizons probe that just passed by Pluto yesterday at about 7:45 in the morning, and they have a lot of great new pictures of Pluto. I encourage folks to look at that online. As you might have heard, like a couple years ago, poor little Pluto was downgraded from a regular planet to a dwarf planet, and now that they have close-up pictures of that, they're rethinking that downgrade, but also noticing that Pluto has frozen water, an abundance of it, on its surface, and vast mountain ranges that were created by the movement of that water. So it's a major discovery in the world of space, and it's just one of those, you know, things that how it applies to healthcare is, you know, at all of these scientific discoveries and advances normally help other fields as well. So it's good to see NASA hit another milestone and breach an historic milestone in space exploration.
No, it was kind of cool to be able to see those pictures, and I'm really excited for Pluto that it might get upgraded again. You know, I felt so bad.
Poor Pluto.
I know, poor
you
Pluto.
Know, Mickey's always bossing him around, and he's got Donald.
I know.
And you know, who knows what Donald's saying half the time. I mean, it's just like blah, blah, blah. It's like, can't even understand the guy. And then after all that, being downgraded to a dwarf planet, you know, it's poor Pluto. You know,
give Pluto free.
Hashtag free Pluto.
There we go. Oh, no.
And speaking of hashtags, folks can interact with either Tammy or I with the hashtag CIC Live. See that segue, Tammy? I'm a
there we go. That was awesome. You're on top of your game tonight.
Hashtag CIC Live. At any time on Twitter, you can tag that on there, and Tammy and I will see that, and we'll be able happy to interact with you and respond to any questions you have. If you have any questions from our guests or for our guests, we can pass those along through Twitter and Facebook as well. You know, I encourage you to go to our Twitter account and our Facebook account and interact and continue the great conversations that we have on the show every week. Tammy.
Absolutely. And we have next week, we have Jane Wilkins. She'll be returning next week. And then also the week after that, I have a guest that's coming on. His name is Matt Gerwell, and he's a former State Highway Patrol officer in the state of Ohio. And once he retired, he had realized that there were many conversations where he'd have to go and knock on someone's door late at night, early in the morning, in regards to an accident. And he has created this wonderful program in which instead of the concept of taking away the keys from a senior driver, really helping them to transition from the driver's seat to the passenger seat. And it's an amazing program that he's put together. It's really helped families to deal with this in a much different way. And I'm very excited to be able to have him on the show at the end of the month as well.
Sounds like a great lineup coming up the next couple of weeks.
It is. And then I have, let's see here, some of the other things that are happening. There's Gary Shiner is going to be coming on in August. He has written a book called Think Like a Pancreas. He's an amazing man. He's a gentleman with, I'm sorry, was that
like
over enthusiastic?
No. Think Like a Pancreas is it's a very catchy title.
It is, and he's a gentleman with type 1 diabetes, and He also is, I believe, a certified diabetes educator, but he's had a lot of practice in really figuring out the best ways for people to really get some good results when it comes to type 1 diabetes and working with pumps and CGMs and you name it. And also even some unique things in working with some type 2 diabetes medications with type 1 as well. So I'm very excited to have him on the show. And then in September, there's a gentleman that will be coming on the show was a caregiver to his wife who had breast cancer. So it'll be a great conversation to talk with him about as well. So we've got some great shows coming up, and I'm looking forward to getting back on the air. It's been a long time, and this is definitely some medicine for me to be back here and talking to everyone.
Well, it's always medicine for us, Tammy, and we provide really great information, and I'm looking forward to helping you do that here over the next couple weeks.
I really appreciate it, Tony, and I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Conversations in Care. Make sure you go to those places Tony suggested, Facebook and Twitter. Talk to us. We'll talk back. And I wanted to make sure that you all are well. Stay well.